Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Over the last several weeks, WFAE has been delving into the price we pay for health care. That cost is twice as high as what consumers in other Western nations are paying, and our outcomes don't justify those higher prices. One major contributing factor to our higher costs is what we pay for pharmaceuticals. Americans pay, on average, 2.5 times what people in other Western nations pay for the same medicines. Why? Who's benefiting, aside from the pharmaceutical companies? And what can be done, if anything, to lower those costs? Here to help us navigate the maze of interconnected causes and get to the bottom of all this is Dr. Stacy Duzitsina, Associate Professor of Health Policy at Vanderbilt University Medical Center and an expert on pharmaceuticals. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Also with us is Dr. G. Bai, Professor of Accounting at Johns Hopkins Carey Business School and a Professor of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She joins us by phone from Washington. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Mike.
And Tahir Amin is co-founder and co-executive director of IMAC. That's not a computer. It's Initiative for Medicines, Access, and Knowledge. That's a company working for equity in drug development and access. And he joins us from New York. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Duzitsina, let me start with you. We're going to talk about a lot of things on this program today that make drug prices higher here than they are in other Western countries, including Canada, by the way. Among them, our system that seems to keep prices of almost everything dealing with healthcare opaque to the consumer, which allowed drug companies to charge ever-escalating prices because after the copay, we don't see what they charge. The insurance companies pretty much see what they charge. We never see it. This tracks, because we've done a lot of shows on this and a lot of pieces to this series on the price we pay, this tracks how the rest of healthcare works in America. So let me ask a bottom line question right at the start. Is our system rigged so that healthcare providers, pharmaceutical companies, etc., can make whatever they want?
Yes, everybody is making a ton of money on the current system. And right now, we don't do very much at all to rein in prices for prescription drugs. So I'd say, yes, pretty rigged.
Wow. And how did it become so? Policy or greed or capitalism or how?
You know, I think that everybody is acting in their own best interests. So the system is kind of has been built in a way that allows companies to name their prices for the drugs that they produce. And we have just seen over time drugs become a greater and greater part of our healthcare system. So I think there are a lot of factors that are in play, but one of them is that we've, you know, really held on to these capitalist principles that, you know, companies can develop new technology, they bring these drugs to the market, and then they can price them at what we say is what the market will bear. So, you know, it's a kind of name your price situation. And the ways that we control prices are through competition, like in the general free market that we think about typically. So in some cases where we have a lot of competition, we do see drug prices being lowered, even in the United States. Although one of the things that is very complex is that a lot of drugs don't have competition. So we don't have a lot of drugs yeah. with generic competition yet. We have a lot of disease areas that are complex. So things like cancer, where there's not a lot of head-to-head competition, and then it's just a name your price game.
Yeah, we're going to talk about all of those things in the course of this hour. There are drugs for clinical therapies that are monstrously expensive, and perhaps some of that expense is justified because the market is so small and the research and development prices were so high. But then there are things like insulin that have been on the market, and the price of insulin has gone up precipitously in the last several years and caused some people to think twice about administering their much-needed daily shots. Dr. Bai, in the episode that we aired recently on drug prices here, we reported that pharmaceutical copays are picked up in some cases for those who cannot afford to pay them by charities. And just last night, I saw a slew of pharmaceutical commercials on television, some of which ended by saying, if you can't pay for this, our company will find a way to maybe help you. And that's wonderful for the consumer. But what we found out in that episode is on the back end, drug companies can jack up the price of the drug to cover the cost. Let me back up here. These charities, some of these pharmaceutical companies have a financial interest in these charities. So the charities pay your, maybe I should have you explain it. The charities will pay your deductible, but then the companies, the pharmaceutical companies, make money on that. Talk to me about that.
Yes, that's exactly what's happening. So these charities are functioning as a marketing department for the pharmaceutical companies. So by removing the cost of sharing, or we can say out-of-pocket expenditure for patients, and the patients do not have any skin in the game. Well, what does that mean? No matter how expensive the drugs are, the patients do not feel any cost exposure. So consider this, you buy an iPhone, the iPhone's price has no impact on your pocket, then you would not care about the price, right? So this is a very smart scheme. By removing patients' skin in the game, drug companies can increase price without facing pushback from consumers.
And in fact, not only can they set their own price because we don't see it, on the back end, because they have an interest in the charity, I'm told that they can take the tax deduction for the contribution they made by paying your deductible. So they're winning on both sides of the equation. Would that be accurate?
That is correct. On the surface, it's charitable contributions, and as you said, can, you know, be used for tax deduction, and it has a marketing purpose, right? It looks good and advancing charitable mission. It is very good for the PR purpose, but in the essence, these programs actually serve as a marketing tool to show the patients some cost exposure in order to increase demand for the price for the drugs and reduce pushback for the price increases.
So clearly, this is all legal, but why is it allowed, especially since taxpayers are footing the bill for these profits that these drug companies are making, and because politicians have been railing against the rising cost of healthcare for years when they're enabling it?
But, you know, many of these things are actually loopholes created by politicians who, many of the politicians receive donations for their political campaigns from pharmaceutical manufacturers. In fact, the pharmaceutical industry has been one of the major, most important industries in political donations. So they have a lot of sway in regulatory and legislative process. So it is not surprising at all that we see these loopholes are actually, you know, put there, maybe intentionally or semi-intentionally, to create opportunities for drug companies to take advantage of in order to make more profit.
Dr. Tahir Amin, you are with this Initiative for Medicines Access and Knowledge, and you study healthcare systems and drug companies across the world, in fact. Is this one of the reasons why we're paying 2.5 times what they pay for the same medicines in the European Union?
I think that there, as somebody who's lived, you know, I'm from the United Kingdom, we have a national health service. I'm not saying it's perfect, but I've lived in the United States for a good 15 years now, and I still don't understand the healthcare system here. It's impossible. It's almost deliberately designed to be confusing. And I think that's what my co-panelists have mentioned are some of the key reasons. Another reason is that companies here can use the patent system, which for listeners who are not familiar with what patents are granted on scientific inventions or any other types of invention, but inventions from pharmaceuticals, which allow companies to get at least a period of 20 years of what we call a limited monopoly. That means nobody else can sell that drug. But over the last 40 years, through various policies and the way the courts have sort of started aligning more favorably with patents, we've seen companies now starting to stretch out that 20 years and piling on as many patents as possible in order to delay competition from coming in. So instead of competition coming in at the sort of on the 20-year mark, competitors are getting pushed out sort of 10 years further. So those prices, they can keep charging higher prices during those extended periods, you know, beyond what their patent term should have been. And I think when we compare many of the top-selling drugs on the market in the United States to what's in Europe, most of those drugs have actually have some kind of a generic version or biosimilar version on the market now in Europe, whereas in the United States, because of patent games, those companies, the branded companies, are still holding the monopoly.
As we've talked about the cost of healthcare here, including pharmaceuticals in America, and compared it to the European Union and other Western industrialized nations, including Canada, because a lot of Americans try to get some of their more expensive drugs from pharmacies in Canada, even though it's not legal yet. We look at those nations who are paying much less for the same drugs, and we think, well, we must, as American consumers, we must be subsidizing them. And you say that's not the case. What is? Tahir.
To me, well, yeah. I think it goes back to Stacey said, and I think there is a, you know, you mentioned the word capitalism. I think there's a runaway train in terms of like it's a profit at all costs, and the idea that we're not going to get any new drug development if we don't allow companies to charge whatever prices they can, sort of what the market can bear. They say, well, the US is saying that we're investing so much, or US companies saying we're investing so much in R&D and what have you, and we're paying all the cost of that, therefore other countries should be paying that too. I think that's a sort of, that's a backwards argument. It's basically what they're saying then is that we should have the license to charge whatever we want, wherever we want, and everyone else should pay for it. Whereas really what we should be saying is, actually we can still get a lot of these new products to market, but you can't charge, you know, sort of an arm and a leg for it. And just remember also, I want to say, many of the arguments about this innovation argument, I think that's a fundamental problem in this whole discussion, is that the industry hides behind this innovation argument. They say basically, if we don't allow them to charge these prices, or they will not fund new products, and we will see a less innovation. Well, first of all, looking from a patent perspective, as a lawyer who's practiced on the commercial side and in the public sector, in public interest side, many of these patents are not actually that new. And there's a French magazine called Prescrire, which actually judges the therapeutic benefits of many of the new drugs that come to market. And actually nearly 70% of them have no added benefit. So what they're doing is they're recycling a lot of science, and they're making up and doing a lot of marketing to say that actually this is slightly better for some sort of compliance benefit or what have you. But it's
and,
not
and really. Are they not allowed to do that in the European Union or other Western nations? Because surely patent protection is important, particularly if you invest a lot of money in research and development. You want to protect your investment for at least a period of time. Does that not happen in
That happens in Europe too, but you have other safety sort of safety nets. You have negotiation. You can negotiate prices, which is something that the Democrats are trying to do it now with the HR3 bill. You have other ways, and the patent games don't get played out as much as they do in the United States. Remember, the United States is the biggest market for these companies, so they'll do anything to defend this territory.
So much more to talk about with regard to why we pay so much more for these drugs, which Dr. Dusit Sinha says are financially toxic for American workers. We'll come back. We'll talk about that. We'll talk some more about research and development and the impact of that on what we pay and other cost factors as well when we continue with Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the price of pharmaceuticals and the fact that they're 2.5 times more expensive in this country than they are in most of the rest of the Western world with Tahir Amin. I keep trying to make him a doctor, but he's not. He is, however, the co-founder and co-executive director of an organization that studies these things all over the world, Initiative for Medicines, Access, and Knowledge. Dr. G. Bai is with us, a professor of accounting and a professor of Health, Policy, and Management at Johns Hopkins, and Dr. Stacy Dusitsina, Professor of Health Policy at Vanderbilt. And Dr. Dusitsina, I quoted you a moment ago from an article I read in Consumer Reports from several years ago in which you said, high drug prices are financially toxic for American workers. Out-of-pocket expenses are, in fact, bankrupting a lot of people, American workers, while others simply forego filling prescriptions because it's either that or eating. So they choose to eat and not fill their prescriptions. How big a problem is this, and why haven't policymakers done more to address it?
So I think it's a really big problem. When you look at surveys, you know, we'll often see that 1 in 4 people or 1 in 5 are struggling to fill their prescriptions. And I think over time, it's been something that has started to impact more and more people. So we've seen more employers using high deductible health plans, for example, where employees and patients have to pay the full price of a drug to fill their prescription. So we know that this is becoming more common. And I think in general, it is a big problem. For policymakers, you would think this would be low-hanging fruit for going after because it would be a big win, really popular with people who need access to medicines, workers, seniors on the Medicare program. But as all things in politics, it's complicated. And often when we think about ways to improve insurance coverage, that comes at reducing the price of prescriptions as one way to pay for that. So we need to lower the price of drugs. We need to improve the benefits, the health insurance benefits. We need to do both of those things at the same time. And as Dr. Bai mentioned earlier, these are politically complicated because these industries have a lot of clout. And so it's hard to do anything meaningful to reduce spending on prescription drugs, even though ultimately we know that a lot of our friends and neighbors are suffering because they can't access their prescriptions.
Name brand prescription drugs, I'm told, make up about 10% of the drugs that Americans consume, and yet they account for 70 to 80% of what we pay overall for drugs. How much of that is due to how we award patents and how long we allow those patents to be and how the process that we use to allow drug companies to extend the patents that Tahir Amin referred to a moment ago versus other factors in our healthcare system, Dr. Dusitsina? Where does the real problem lie?
So patents are part of it. And I think there is a tension between thinking about rewarding innovation and giving companies an opportunity to recoup investments. So that's one reason we have the original patent system, is that you develop a technology, you want to get paid for doing so. But what we've seen over time is that a lot of companies will just keep extending these patents so they can go on for many, many years beyond what they were originally intended. And we know that companies will just, you know, they'll launch their drugs, they'll put them on the market as high as they can with their prices, and then they'll keep increasing their prices. And so you mentioned insulin earlier. This is a product that hasn't had that many new developments, you know, like maybe the device that we're using to inject the insulin has changed over time, but the fundamental product hasn't really been, you know, changed that much. So you see the price of that continue to climb and you see no competition coming into the market. So from a patient and consumer perspective, you know, there's not a lot new there, but it's becoming something that's incredibly expensive. And with the patents still on maybe on the pen or the device that you're using to inject it, it makes it really hard for a competitor to come into the market. So the prices just stay high.
Dr. Bry, drug companies, and we referred to this earlier in this conversation, drug companies often point to the need for research and development and the great expense that they go to in researching and developing these drugs. And we know that some of them complain that it takes 10, 15 years to get approval through the FDA approval process, which adds to the costs as well. Aren't these complaints legitimate, or are they inflating their complaints to justify the prices?
Well, I think there's merit in that argument. People do have to work for something. Like, if it's not the case that the researchers or smart people are willing to work for something just in order to get a good cause. People work for money. And I believe the good system has to harness individuals' greed in order to create, innovate. So there's definitely some effort, investment put into the whole process. And the payoff is not just for the payoff for the single company. It is to create an incentive, a carrot in the society to attract potential smart people to invest their time and their life into the space. Well, that being said, we have a huge problem that, you know, drug companies are abusing the current patent system to abuse their market exclusivity and to rig the political system for the advantage. However, I think we should make very clear distinction between the good innovation, like the innovation really save lives, really advance the population health, from the bad innovation, which is like compound drugs, me-too drugs, to, you know, old drugs we put together, charge a very high price. So if we cannot make clear distinction between the two, then, you know, any heavy-handed policy innovations will actually create a lot of unintended consequences.
I want to be fair about this to the pharmaceutical companies, and I want to use, and it's kind of a dangerous thing to use at this moment, but I want to use the development of the COVID vaccines as an example. Now, we know that the research and development that went into these mRNA vaccines had been going on for a decade at least prior to the development of this vaccine or these vaccines by Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson for COVID-19, which led to their ability to develop them relatively quickly. But what really was surprising to a lot of people, and has also frightened some people, is the rapidity with which they got approval from the FDA. It usually takes, as we said, a decade or more sometimes to get approval from the FDA. These things were approved in months, which has led some people to believe that corners were cut. Dr. Bai, if we can do it for vaccines that we need desperately, can we do it for other drugs and still be safe? Can we cut the time the FDA requires for research and development and testing?
Well, I am not a physician, so that is beyond my expertise. But I do believe that reducing the regulatory process and the regulatory burden will definitely improve innovation effort.
We've talked, Tahir Amin, about patents and about how our patent system is different from that in the European Union and how it can add to the cost of this because the patent system is being manipulated or abused, whatever word you want to use, by the drug companies to their benefit. But they also do something else. It's called pay for delay. I'm not sure what that means, but I think that you do, and you can tell me how it figures into the price we pay for drugs.
Yeah, so pay for delay is really something that comes out of patent litigation. If a generic company wants to come into the market, the way the system is designed is it has to file its generic version or biosimilar version with the FDA, but then the FDA has to check it against if there are any patents or if the branded company is going to enforce any litigation against the competitor. And then you start the clock, the litigation proceedings. And so typically what happens during patent litigation is the companies may decide it's better to settle than actually fight the case all the way through and clear the marketplace. And traditionally, a lot of patent litigation cases end up in settlement because the original way of settling was, if I'm the branded company, I'll give you $1 billion. You stay off the market for another 4 or 5 years or whatever it is. And then basically you can come in as the first entrant because you get this kind of, it almost becomes like a sort of a duopoly where the generic can come in for and get 6 month exclusivity. This is the way the system was to try and incentivize generics to challenge patents and also get some exclusivity as well. So you've got these kind of exclusivity systems within exclusivity systems. And so that was the classic way that pay for delay, but there was a Supreme Court case in 2013, which tried to sort of nullify some of that, but not very successfully. It was a kind of wishy-washy decision. And so companies have already moved away from that classic sort of, I'll pay you money to stay off the market. And they're using other ways. For example, if you look at AbbVie, the drug Humira, the best-selling drug currently on the market, they settled with some 8 or 9 companies and they said, we'll give you the European market, but we're going to keep the US one for ourselves until 2023. And that's another form of paying for delay. But unfortunately, our antitrust system doesn't really see it that way. The antitrust laws have been literally diluted over the last 30, 40 years of policy. Largely to favor pharmaceutical companies, at least in terms of using the way the patents, the way they do. So pay for delay is really just about, it's a way of keeping competition off the market. And the important point is that you can only do pay for delay if you are able to stack up all these patents. So there's a lot of efforts to sort of legislate for or bills to try and curtail pay for delay. But I always say, you can't solve the pay for delay problem unless you solve the patent problem, because that's where all the power starts. And I think that's what our policyholders really need to understand.
What I'm hearing in this conversation and many of the other conversations we've had on the price we pay for healthcare is that one of the culprits in all of this is the government and policy set by the government. When a drug company develops a drug, they have these patents that give them the exclusive right to produce that drug, and they can charge whatever they want to for that drug if the price can be paid by somebody down the line. General Motors can charge whatever it wants to for a Chevy Tahoe, but if you don't want to pay that, you can go to Ford and buy the equivalent model. You can't do that in the drug world. Why is it, Dr. Dizitsina, why is it that we regard these two industries as equivalent? They're not.
That's a really great question. I mean, I think there are so many things that are different about healthcare and prescription drugs. You know, the person who's ultimately paying the copay or filling the drug and taking the drug isn't the person who's necessarily making the decision about it. So you need your doctor to write a prescription for you. Your health insurance company is making some decisions about what's covered on their formulary and what you'd have to pay, what's preferred. So the market is just not the same as if you went to buy a car. You know, you don't really have the same level of choices. We also don't have the same level of information. I study prescription drugs for the last 10 to 12 years, and I still wouldn't be able to necessarily make a lot of informed healthcare decisions. I would trust my doctor to be making those decisions and recommendations for me. So there's like an information asymmetry as well. You can't easily make these decisions for yourself. And even if you could, you can't just go out and purchase most of these without a prescription. So the market doesn't work the same as it does everywhere else, but we try to treat it like it does.
And in many cases, these drugs that we require in certain cases are life and death situations where you don't have time to make the decision. That's the only option you have. It costs X amount of dollars. If you want to continue living, you need to take it. You need to pay for it. You need to buy it. That's a problem, it seems to me, that needs to be addressed by government policy. Why is it that it seems that big companies have much more sway than voters?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I completely agree with you that when you are not well and you need some of these medicines, these really expensive medicines, the last thing you want to be doing is fighting the battle of, you know, how to change policy and change the system. I am an internal optimist. I hope that we can get to a place where we make the policies fit better for improving access to care. And to me, what that means is that we start to really pay more appropriately for drugs. Yeah. We reward the good innovation, as Dr. Bai said, you know, there's good innovation, there's bad innovation. If we could get smarter about how we pay for things, we could do a better job of making drugs more affordable so that when you're sick, you're not the person having to fight that battle or think about paying for your mortgage versus paying for your prescription, which is a place that too many Americans are in.
Dr. Bai, we've talked about all these things that raise the cost of drugs in America, and one of the things we have not talked about yet are individuals called pharmacy benefits managers. These are middlemen. They work under contract with health insurance companies who decide which drugs those companies will cover. Pharmaceutical companies often blame them for the high costs we pay because those pharmacy benefits managers push up the costs of the drugs by demanding rebates from the insurance company. But an organization representing these pharmacy benefits managers say that isn't so, that in fact their work keeps premiums low for consumers because the rebates make the drugs cost less for the insurance company. How do you see it? How big a factor is this in what we pay for drugs here? Dr. Bai.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So the PBMs, or pharmacy benefit managers, play an important role in negotiating with drug companies. So let's say tomorrow no PBMs exist, then there's really no counteracting forces against the drug manufacturers' pricing, then we'll see higher drug price. However, because PBMs, as any other entities, must make money, and their goal is to maximizing shareholders' wealth. So they're trying any way they can to make money from those complex transactions. One thing they can do is to put high rebate, high price drugs with about the same therapeutic benefits on drug formularies that steer patients to those drugs, high price, high rebate drugs, in order to generate more profit for themselves. Then we have a imperfect, inefficient drug selection formulary that push patients to less effective, cost-effective drugs. So that is the major problem in the current PBM and manufacturing relationship.
And are they the only people, Dr. Dizitsina, who are pushing up drugs? What about in the places you go to get them, like pharmacies, like CVS, like Walgreens, are they also in control of this? Very quickly.
Yeah, to some degree. One of the things that I think when you study this, you see is that a lot of insurance companies and PBMs are owned by the same parent company. So there's a lot of relationships going on there and a lot to tease apart.
And all of this is legal. It boggles the mind. We're going to come back with more of why we pay so much in this country for drugs when the rest of the world is skating through in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins to talk about the price we pay for drugs as part of our ongoing series here on WFAE. Tahir Amin is the co-founder and co-executive director of IMAC, Initiative for Medicines, Access, and Knowledge. Dr. Stacy Dizitsina is an associate professor of health policy at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, and Dr. G. Bai is a professor of accounting and health policy and management at Johns Hopkins Schools of Business and the School of Public Health. And Dr. G, we keep hearing about insurance companies having partial ownership of charities that help you pay for the drugs, and they get to take the tax deduction on the back end of having made that contribution to your buying their drug. We hear about them owning interests in the places that you buy the drugs from, so they're winning on all sides. Are they doing this because they have to, because they had to find workarounds because of the high cost of the drugs that they themselves produced and the fact that it is unsustainable, that people can't afford these drugs anymore? Is that why they're doing it? Or is this just a way to make more money?
Of course, I would say that is the main reason, right? We are in a capitalist society. Drug companies, as any other corporations, have only one goal, or legally designated goal, that is to maximize shareholder wealth. So I think they have to find a way to to create more money for themselves and for their shareholders.
Well, they're doing a good job because middlemen are being blamed for the 78% rise of the cost of the arthritis drug Humira since 2014 from $874 to $1,552 in 2019, and drug company profits have risen as well in that time. John emails, I use insulin. When I had insurance, I was prescribed Levemir. Now that I have no insurance, I have been prescribed Novolin N, a similar time-release insulin. Levemir costs 39 times as much per unit as Novolin N. Using Novolin N saves me over $850 a month. Novolin N is available over-the-counter at Walmart. Which leads me to a question about this, Tahira. I mean, we live in a consumer society. We are used to being marketed to and advertised to by every known product in the known universe. Drugs have become one of them. I don't recall drugs being, except for Bufferin and Alka-Seltzer, being advertised on television when I was a kid. But now everything is. Obscure cancer drugs that 10 people in the world need are being advertised on TV. Americans tend to gravitate toward name brands. We've been trained to do that. Is that part of the reason we pay more? Because even when generics are available, we don't trust them?
It's the United States and New Zealand are the only two countries in the world that I'm aware of actually have direct-to-consumer marketing on TV. So I think it does, I'm sure, have a lot to do with the way consumers are responding and acting, because marketing is a very powerful instrument, and particularly when you see, as you said earlier in this show, every other minute you're watching the television, there's a drug advert, and it's people see that on TV and they'll go to their physician and say, oh, you know, I heard about this, and that's how it works. So I think, and if you look at the marketing spend of pharmaceutical companies, it often, and in fact, there's various studies on this, it outstrips the amount they spend on R&D. So marketing is a fundamental part of this business model. And all the, you know, the sort of cries about, oh, you're going to kill, quote unquote, innovation. Well, really what they're doing, they need a lot of that money to keep marketing a lot of this stuff to you so that they can keep you sort of going to your physician and doing the job for them.
One of the things that you're involved in, Dr. Dzitsina, at Vanderbilt is cancer research and working on measuring and evaluating the use and costs of medicine used to treat cancer in the United States. Where generics are available for things like that, are they as effective, are they as safe as their name brand cousins? And if more Americans insisted on generics over the name brands, would that lower our costs or would that kill future innovation?
So as far as whether they're as safe or effective, yes. Generic drugs are tested and compared with the brand name drugs, so we feel confident that they are safe and effective like the brand. So we should, as a society, want people to switch over to a generic as soon as it's available. The challenge is that there's so much new drug development in the cancer space, and there aren't that many spaces where we feel like we've done a great job and we've solved cancer. So what tends to happen is that when an older drug loses its patent, we've had newer treatments be developed in the cancer space that are slightly better maybe than the older product. And that marketing that you were just talking about, there's also direct physician marketing, not just the ads you see on TV, but your physicians having people come into their offices and tell them about these new products. So even if they're only a little better, they may be enough to push, you know, the prescribing decision to the new drug that's expensive. So in the cancer space, we have a lot of challenges, including this desire to move to new drugs.
But overall, over-the-counter aspirins or versions of Tylenol that are branded with the pharmacy's name and not the original Tylenol name, other drugs that may be prescribed for other conditions other than cancer, they are equally effective as their cousins, their name brand cousins, and we should have no reluctance to take them. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. You know, we do bioequivalence testing. You know, FDA does require that these manufacturers show that they are producing the same product. It works in the same way. So, yeah, I think when there's a generic available, and if that is something that's covered by your plan, which it almost always is, take the generic, save that money.
In fact, Dr. Bai, a lot of insurance companies will only pay for the generic version of a drug. What impact, if any, has that had on costs?
Yes, to switching from branded to generic in general will save money. However, we're facing two obstacles. Number one is from patients. In my own cross-study study, we found that many patients actually have a strong preference for branded drugs. But the benefit design showed them from paying a lot of higher cost sharing for the branded drug. So that really creates an incentive for the patients who have strong preference for branded drugs to take branded drugs. The second obstacle is physicians. Many physicians, they write the prescriptions as branded and want the patient to take branded drugs. That might come from the marketing or direct to physician marketing, as Lucy just mentioned. So those two forces are, you know, preventing a more broad adoption of generic drugs in addition to some PBM manipulated drug formulary issue.
Dana Miller Irvin, who is the producer and reporter behind WFAE's The Price We Pay series, says that in other wealthy countries to here, like Germany and France, which you've studied, scientists assess each drug's benefits and price them accordingly. Companies that develop novel cures get more, but they get less if there is an alternative treatment. And she reports that Dr. Aaron Kesselheim from Harvard Medical School insists that system would be a step up from the one we currently have in this country. If you agree, why haven't we moved to that model?
I think it is a step up. I think if, for example, going back to my birthplace, the United Kingdom, I'm not saying it's the perfect system, but they have a system where an agency called NICE really assesses these the efficacy of drugs and whether it's the price that's worth paying. Now, there's a body in the United States called ICER, which tries to do this. It's a non-official body, but it does actually try to put what they think is a price that matches the drug's efficacy and what's providing to patients compared to what already exists. So it's we slowly started to get that into the system, but I do think that we do need an official body like that, that is a governmental body that can actually play that role, because then you're getting some form of negotiation in terms of, well, we don't think this drug is actually that much better than the last drug, and we're only going to pay X amount for it. Now, what happens, as we've had in the United Kingdom, certain patients may then say they start crying foul, because what happens is a lot of patient groups that are actually funded by pharmaceutical companies just kind of put pressure on these agencies. So wherever you look, their tentacles are everywhere. I mean, in fact, you know, there's studies that have shown that most patient groups in the United States are actually funded by pharmaceutical companies. In fact, I only know two that aren't, and that's T1 and Patients for Affordable Drugs that aren't funded by pharmaceutical companies.
In that Price We Pay series, Dana Irvin spends time talking about a cancer treatment drug called Revlimid, which I'm told costs $17,000 a month and is produced by Bristol Myers Squibb. They would not speak to us, but they did send a statement which reads, "We take great care to price our medicines based on the value they deliver, the innovation they represent, economic factors that impact healthcare systems' capacity to provide care, and the investment necessary to develop drugs." That doesn't sound all that different to hear from what goes on in Germany or France, is it?
No, it is. I mean, look, it's the same drug. They're making profits in Germany. They're making profits in Europe, but they're just not making as much as they are in the United States. I think the U.S. market is unique in the way that it allows. I mean, essentially, people might call it the freest market, and that's the model that pharmaceutical companies want projected in other countries. And that's the push. The actual, what they're trying to do is they're trying to get European countries to have that model, this model. And the European countries are hanging on to this. The United Kingdom, for example, the crown jewels is the NHS system, and there's the ability to negotiate prices. But there's this battle playing out. You know, last couple of years ago, when after the UK Brexited, there was talk of a UK-US trade agreement, and pharmaceutical pricing and shaping the market in the way it is in the United States was on the table. So there's a lot of, you know, even in the previous administration, this idea that, oh, the US is paying for all the drug costs. We need to put our model on them, as opposed to saying, actually, their model is better. We should have Chiavi over here. So this is all because of the lobbying and the pressure that the pharmaceutical industry is doing, because they want to create markets in the way they want it that serves their purpose. And that means charging more prices.
We've said, Dr. Duzitsima, that these drug companies can charge whatever they want. And any company in America making anything can charge whatever they want. And the question is, will people pay for it? And the answer to this is, if you need Revlimid, which is that cancer drug I referred to a minute ago, yes, somebody has to pay for it. It's $17,000 a month. But I'm also told this is a highly targeted drug needed by only a very few patients. I think at last report, only 96 patients in the country need this drug. Does the fact that it's such a small market niche justify the price?
So I think that the point that was just made, that other countries are profiting on the prices that they have for this drug, and we are paying much, much more than those countries, kind of is something to consider here. Revlimid is one of the drugs that we've spent the most on in the country, even given that small number of patients that take it. When you look year after year, so in the Medicare program, for example, it tends to be within the top 10 or 20 most highest spending drugs in that program. And if you're thinking about that small number of people, it means it's got a tremendous price tag. I don't think the company is hurting for funds right now. It's a blockbuster drug for them. And it's an important drug, but I think that the price, it's just too high.
We've been talking about the cost of American healthcare for generations now. I think one of the first presidents to try to do something about this was, I think, Richard Nixon. I may be wrong about that. He couldn't do it. Hillary Clinton tried to do it during the Bill Clinton administration. She couldn't do it. Obamacare is here, but it is a faint, it's kind of a ghost of what it was intended to be because of the compromises that had to be reached. President Trump tried to do something about prescription drug prices and wasn't able to do it. Congress is once again battling over whether to allow Medicare to negotiate prices, but again, it's facing opposition. Americans care very much about what they pay for drugs. Why is this politically difficult for people in Congress? Dr. Duzitsina.
I think lobbying is very powerful. So, you know, one of the things that's hard is that we feel very much pressure to do something about prices, but we also recognize that this is a high value industry. You know, we value a lot of things that the pharmaceutical industry has produced, so there creates a tension. But I do think that the political influence of the industry, even thinking about all the ads that we're all seeing on television right now, probably depending on where you live, you're getting inundated with messaging about the innovation of pharmaceutical products and how doing anything to negotiate is going to harm access or hurt people on Medicare. And these are scare tactics that are just meant to, you know, save the industry profits.
As you said, Tahir, I mean, the pharmaceutical industry has their tentacles everywhere, and they are a powerful lobby politically in this country and probably elsewhere. As we talk about what we pay for American healthcare and what we pay for drugs, what's your opinion? You know, knowing what you know about other systems in other parts of the world, is our system fixable? Or is it so screwed up that we should just junk the whole thing and start over? And is that even possible?
Well, I don't think it's possible to just totally turn it over overnight. But you said about we've been, you know, all the various administrations and you know, you said Nixon. Well, actually, it goes back further. If you think the real change that tried to happen was in 1962, Senator Kefauver was really trying to really change this whole system. And I think the same arguments that are used in 1962 are being used today. So I think we have to get out of the ideology and think about
this. Tahir Amin with IMAC, Initiative for Medicines, Access, and Knowledge, Dr. G. Bai with Johns Hopkins, and Dr. Stacey Dusitsina from Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Thank you all. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.